This has been a historic race, and it's not over just yet. One political analyst says this race could lead to more recounts in the future.
The likelihood of different outcomes has now changed, but really what has happened overall is that everyone has a better appreciation of the power of their vote.
Do they? Do they really? We'll discuss.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am. Stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have, of course, another busy day in the news today. Go figure. And guest standing by to join me momentarily regarding elections here in California and questions about our post-election procedures here, which will be critical all over the nation, post-election procedures. We're going to be more critical this year than ever, given what we expect from, yes, Donald Trump supporters in the event that he is named the loser again this year in 2024, as he was in 2020. I sometimes go back and forth, Desi Doyen, whether I'm more worried about Donald Trump winning or Donald Trump losing.
Yeah,
at this point.
I know. It's kind of both, isn't it?
Yep. Among the many things of note in the news today and since we last spoke that I hope to get to in a little bit, perhaps along with a few of your calls, if time allows, at 818-985-5735. For those in our live Southern California listening area or following us live on the kpfk.org web stream, there's a whole lot of accountability going on today. Late last week, former Donald Trump campaign manager and senior White House advisor Steve Bannon lost his appeal to stay out of prison. That was late last week on his two contempt of Congress charges for refusing to answer subpoenas in the U.S. House's bipartisan January 6 investigation. Disgraced Donald Trump attorney and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani recently found liable for about $150 million in a defamation lawsuit filed by two Atlanta area poll workers who he falsely claimed to have committed election fraud in 2020. So he owes them that money, and now he's having even more trouble. We'll get to that in a bit. Jury selection began on Monday in the federal corruption trial of New Jersey's sitting Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. And, of course, the biggest news of Monday, most likely, Donald Trump's former personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, finally took the stand in the New York State criminal trial against the disgraced former president, in which Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records concerning a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels just weeks before the 2016 presidential election. In his, well, successful effort to avoid, until now, to avoid federal election laws in order to cheat to win the presidency back in 2016. As noted, we'll try to get to as many of those things as we can, along with some of your calls, if time allows. 818-985-KPFK. That's in a bit. But first, as the as to the 2024 election, on Tuesday, voters in Nebraska, Maryland, and West Virginia are heading to the polls for primary elections, where although the presidential contests are all but officially decided in those primaries, with both Joe Biden and Donald Trump having won enough delegates to be named their respective parties' nominees at the conventions over the summer, there are still a number of critical U.S. House, Senate, and in some cases, state and local races on the ballot on Tuesday. So if you live in one of those three states, it's a great chance to get out, vote, and make sure you're registered as you think you are, to avoid as many surprises as possible in this November's critical general elections. But as you know, on this program, while we cover the horse race, we spend as much or more time on the track conditions on which those horses are running, because the track conditions, a muddy track, a sloppy track, can make all the difference in a horse race, even for the very best of horses. To that end, last week on one of our shows, we spoke with longtime election integrity and transparency expert Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance. She, of course, is the woman responsible for revealing the unlawful breach and copy and distribution of Georgia's statewide voting system software by Trump operatives after the 2020 election in Coffee County, Georgia. That, her discoveries have led to indictments for five of the 19 people charged in Donald Trump's broad conspiracy indictment for his plot to steal the 2020 election in the Peach State. We also got an update on her recently ended trial seeking to a civil lawsuit trial seeking to ban the use of Georgia's 100% unverifiable and vulnerable to manipulation touchscreen voting systems in Georgia, still shamefully forced on voters at the polls across the entire state, and the problems that that may cause again this year in that critical battleground. But we also discussed her testimony last week before the state elections board in Georgia, pointing out that post-election recounts in the state must be carried out by hand, at least according to state law. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in Georgia does not necessarily follow state law. But they must be counted by hand according to the law, as Maryland tells it, as opposed to simply running the same ballots through the same potentially miscoded computer optical scan system that tallied them the first time. The transparency and citizen oversight of a manual post election recount, she argued, in Georgia is key to assuring legitimacy and confidence among the electorate. Yes, including Trump supporters. In the final results, whatever they may be, that are ultimately reported in that critical battleground state of Georgia. And though California is not a critical presidential battleground state, we do frequently have very close races out here. For example, in many of our U.S. House races, which could this year determine who controls the majority in the U.S. House. That issue, of course, is as important as ever if, for example, Republicans win back the White House and or the Senate this year. So here in California, many of us actually take some pride in the processes that are used for casting and counting votes across the state, including the full 30 days that county registrars are allowed to assure that all votes, including late arriving mail-in votes, are counted and counted correctly as per voter intent. As it is often said, we would rather get it right here in California than get it done quickly. But some interesting vulnerabilities in our electoral system, yes, even here in the Golden State, some of them, in fact, longstanding, which we have reported on over the years, both here and at bradblog.com in detail, some interesting vulnerabilities have emerged yet again during the post-election process following our March 5th Super Tuesday primaries. held just a couple of months ago. You may recall a few weeks ago on this program, we reported on a fascinating story out here where there was an exact tie in one of the U.S. House primary races in the Bay Area. Yes, as we often tell you, every vote counts, even here in California. And if you look at that tie in that race, well, it becomes even more clear. It came in the primary race in the state's 16th U.S. House Congressional District, which stretches across two counties, Santa Clara County and San Mateo, both in Northern California, where there is a hotly contested race for an open U.S. House seat being left vacant this year by the retiring, long-serving 81-year-old Democratic Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. Now, the tie was not a tie for first place in the primary. However, it was a tie for second place. Now, several years ago in California, the state moved to a top two primary system where all candidates from all parties run in the same election, same primary election, and the top two vote getters, regardless of party affiliation, will then go on to run against each other in the November general elections. So you can end up in situations where you have two Republicans running against each other, two Democrats running against each other, and so forth. In the 16th congressional district, there were nearly a dozen candidates running on March 5th, both Republican and Democratic. The Democratic-leaning congressional district had more Democrats running than Republicans, but they were all running in the same race. Former San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, a Democrat, finished in first place with just over 21% of the vote, with 11 people running in that contest. So he got 21% of the vote. And then there was an exact tie for second place, with both Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simitian and State Assembly Member Evan Lowe, both of them also Democrats. They repeatedly sort of traded positions by one vote, you know, while the votes were being counted during the initial canvass after Election Day. But they finished up with 30,249 votes each. Yes, every vote matters. An exact tie for second place. This is the first time that that has ever happened since California moved to its top two primary voting system after the passage of Prop 14 way back in 2010. Apparently, the rules for such a tie in the state is that both candidates, essentially the two that were tied for second place, will go on to compete against the first place candidate in November. So, Liccardo in first place and Simitian and Lowe tied for second place would all three be on the general election ballot for California's 16th U.S. House District this fall. Now, at the time, the astonishing tie in this case was certified as official back when we initially reported on it a few weeks ago. None of the candidates seemed to have an incentive at that point to challenge the results after, a month of second place finishers sort of going back and forth between, you know, one vote, picked up a vote here, picked up a vote there. Nobody knew until it ended up as an exact tie. But nobody had an incentive to ask, for example, for a recount. The first place candidate, Liccardo, would seem to have an advantage in that his opposition would be split between his two opponents. And Lowe and Simitian, those two opponents, who had been, Simitian, by the way, had been endorsed for the seat by the retiring Congresswoman Eshoo. But both Lowe and Simitian would both be heading to the general election, and any recount that they might have asked for would be dangerous. Essentially, a 50-50 proposition that they would lose the coveted spot in the general if even one vote was picked up either way. So it wasn't expected there would be a challenge. They would all three go to the general election in November. So we thought we would be looking at the first ever three-way general election for U.S. House in California's top two primary era. But while California does not hold automatic recounts for U.S. House races, even when they are so close that they are literally, in this case, tied, we do have a law that allows any elector, any voter, to ask for a recount anywhere they like if they are willing to pay for it. The law is such that if the recount results in a change in the certified results, the challenger is supposed to get their money back. It's a good law in one sense, in that it allows any voter to ask to seek a recount. But as we've reported over the years, the registrars in each county are allowed to set the costs for those recounts to pretty much any number they want, and we have reported many times over the years how those prices often seem arbitrary and capricious, with some registrars charging, for example, as little as 10 cents per ballot to recount them, others charging upward of more than a dollar per ballot. Often, putting the price for such recounts, particularly in large contests, out of reach for many who might like to challenge certified results with an official recount. In California's 16th, then, it seemed like all three Democrats were going to be on the ballot this fall, until a guy by the name of Jonathan Padilla, for reasons that are still not entirely clear, decided he wanted to ask for a recount in both Santa Clara and San Mateo counties in order for the results to be changed, or for a requester to get their money back. If that happens, a full count of every ballot in the race must occur under California law. And that means in a contest like CD16, that a requester would have to shell out tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars on the chance that they may receive their money back if the results are changed through the recount process. Now, Padilla, it seems, had long ago worked for the for the first place finisher, Sam Liccardo, for his 2014 mayoral campaign in San Jose 10 years ago. And some have speculated that he might have been seeking a recount for the second place contest to make it easier for Liccardo to race against just one opponent instead of two. Also, it's unclear where the super PAC money is coming from that Liccardo was using to finance the recount. In any event, over the past month or so, that recount has played out in both San Mateo and Santa Clara counties, where they recounted the ballots separately in each county. The initial recount fee was about $32,000 a day, as quoted by the Santa Clara County Registrar's Office, for an approximately 10-day manual hand recount that would cost, in total, about $320,000 for that county alone.
Now, that's a lot of money.
Yes, it is a lot of money.
And it seems to me that it's kind of arbitrary.
Well, in neighboring San Mateo, the cost would be about $84,000 for a manual recount. Yeah, well, smaller county. But before the counting began, Padilla, who said he was seeking the count on behalf of Evan Lowe, one of the two candidates tied for second — you have to say who you're asking for this count on behalf of — he was able to reduce the fees by about half by asking for, instead of a hand count, let's have a machine recount. For his part, the candidate, Evan Lowe, said he had nothing to do with seeking this count and didn't even know this mysterious Jonathan Padilla, as far as I know. So the recount proceeded. It finally finished up at the end of last month. The results did not change that much. The results that were recounted on the same machines that counted them in the first place, the computers, but they didn't have to change that much. Even a change of one vote in either direction, which is hardly unusual in such a recount, would knock one of the two candidates out of the general election this fall. A number of what I see as not that unusual issues came up during the count. A small number of ballots were discovered not to have been tallied in the original account. Others were found to have been accidentally tallied twice. Human errors that really occur every election, no more than a dozen or so in each case. But in an exactly tied race, obviously those mistakes can make a big difference. And of course, there are some ballots, mail-ins, or provisionals that were rejected the first time because signatures didn't match, and those ballots can then be re-examined for possible inclusion during a recount. In the end, Santa Clara County released its final results showing Evan Lowe gaining 11 extra votes and Joe Simitian gaining 7 extra votes, meaning that Lowe led Simitian in that county by 4 votes, Meanwhile, in San Mateo, though an initial rescan of all the ballots showed no change in the results, there were 16 ballots that were challenged that were under review that could have changed the outcome. Seven of those 16 challenges were accepted, and that resulted in Lowe picking up one more vote. Sumitian gained zero votes. In the end, between the two counties, Lowe ended up beating Sumitian by just 5 votes. Knocking Sumitian out of the California 16 contest that will now feature first-place finisher Sam Liccardo against second-place finisher, by just 5 votes, Evan Lowe. Liccardo conceded gracefully, no insurrections, even with a 5-vote margin that was originally a tie. But, oh, by the way, along the way, the California Secretary of State's office rang in to announce that even though the results had changed, in that Liccardo was knocked out and Lowe was going to go alone to the general election against Sumitian was knocked out. Liccardo would go against Lowe only in the primary. Even though the results had changed, Padilla would not be receiving reimbursement for the recount fees. Because as the secretary's office logic goes here, Evan Lowe was going to be in the general anyway, both before and after the recount, so no change and no refund to John Padilla, who paid for all of this.
Oh, man.
According to the Secretary of State, in a legal argument that, boy, sure seems kind of dubious and ripe for challenge to me. Joining us for some insight into what actually happened here and how our age-old recount problems in California sort of reemerged in this recount and how they should be corrected once and for all is Dr. John Ma. He is sort of my go-to guy for many California recount-related issues over the years. He is a San Francisco-based surgeon who asked for and received the recount of Prop 29, a tobacco tax initiative on the primary ballot way back in 2010. It was the first recount of a statewide ballot measure in California history. John Ma has also advised every statewide recount since and advised Evan Lowe's team informally in the CD16 race, the recount. He also gave advice to members of Joe Sumitian's team during the recount in San Mateo. Dr. Ma, it has been years, but welcome back to the broadcast. Do we have you there?
Thanks for having me on the show.
Excellent.
And your interest.
Thank you. John, a lot of lessons here, I think, but not as much time to discuss them as I might like, given everything else that's going on. But first, your broad takeaways from this process in the 16th district, what troubled you about it, what given the years of similar concerns about things like the pricing of recounts in a state that doesn't do them automatically and pay for them automatically. What lessons should lawmakers and voters learn from what happened here in this bizarre matter in San Mateo and Santa Clara?
This was an extraordinary outcome of a tie. It's unusual that it didn't result in a coin toss in the Secretary of State's office. I think there should be legislation. Texas and Vermont would have done an automatic recount in their 23 states where this would have been within the trigger. Mm-hmm. I helped Assemblyman Kevin Mullen in 2014 create a trigger, but it's only for statewide races.
Right.
It's 0.00015% or less than 1,000 votes. Ultimately, I believe that the requester is a hero for election integrity, and they bore the cost of what I believe that the registrar's office should have done, because their certification of a tie was actually an error. I would condition it. This was a machine recount, not a hand recount. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles during Prop 29, we discovered hundreds of votes that were picked up only by a hand recount and not detected in the course of a machine recount. Mm-hmm. And I estimated the cost per ballot for this recount around $1.64. This is very expensive, particularly for a machine recount.
$1.64 per ballot is what it came out to, as you saw it.
Using the lower estimates
right.
of the media of $300,000. I really think there's opportunity for legislation to standardize the costs. They're quite divergent. I believe that this race really is a wake-up call for our Secretary of State and our registrars.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that a recertification or audit should have been done on their own in the case of a tie because of the importance. I believe that the Santa Clara website reads, if the outcome of the recount has changed the election results in the requester's favor, the deposit is returned. Yep. And I would believe that in this instance, Evan Lowe no longer has to face two opponents. He only has to face one. Mm-hmm. And I think if you read both the Secretary of State and the Santa Clara website, there's been a meaningful and substantive change that should result in the refund of Mr. Padilla's money.
Yeah, it certainly seems like he's got a strong case. I mean, he spent several, several hundreds of thousands of dollars at this point on this. And yes, the results did change. And the Secretary of State says, oh, he's not owed the money because Evan Lowe was going to the general anyway. So nothing changed. On a political basis, John Maul, why was this recount sought in the first place by this guy, John Padilla, as you see it, especially since it seemed initially to be sort of a win-win-win for all three candidates who were named to go on to the general election this year? What do we know about John Padilla and why he sought this count? And was it he who actually paid for it, or wasn't it a super PAC whose donors we have not yet been released?
I don't know Mr. Padilla, but I do know his attorney, Mr. Jim Sutton, mm-hmm. a very famous recount firm that helped me with Proposition 29. Joe Simidian was the incumbent endorsed by Anna Eshoo, and one might speculate that there would be an interest to have Mr. Simidian removed from the race and to secure the incumbent's endorsement. Mm. The recount request was made on behalf of Evan Lowe. So if you read the registrar's website and the existing law, you would imagine that the person was hoping that Evan Lowe would be declared the winner mm-hmm. and that they would have their funds returned.
Because they were knocking out the one guy who was endorsed by the longtime, much beloved, I think, sitting Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. So I don't know his motives, Padilla's, but are you suggesting here, and there is evidence that 10 years ago he worked for the first place winner, Liccardo, that this was being done on behalf of Liccardo?
I would anticipate that Mr. Padilla would be knowledgeable and acquainted with a number of the supporters of Mayor Liccardo, who has adamantly denied being involved in the recount request. But I would speculate that it's a group of supporters of Mayor Liccardo who conceptualized and paid for this recount.
Do you have confidence now, John Ma, in the recounted numbers that were tallied again on computers rather than by hand, which apparently would have cost twice as much to this recount fellow or this recount group? Do you have confidence now in the numbers that were all, every single one of them, theoretically recounted again by machines in this case?
I have less confidence than I would if it were a hand recount. Mm-hmm. I do have significant remaining concerns, but I think what this has shown, the likelihood of a tie is a truly rare statistical event. Mm-hmm. And I think that what this has shown very clearly, either Mr. Simidian or Mr. Lowe won this contest. Mm-hmm. And I think if you ran the ballots on a different machine or using a different algorithm mm-hmm. methodology, I would have greater confidence. And I'm just disappointed that the costs were so prohibitive that the requester could not afford the more accurate hand recount, which really will detect undervotes.
And, you know, there was a case about 2 years ago now. We covered it on this show down in the town of Long Beach, where there was a tax initiative that passed that did pass by something like a dozen votes, like 12 votes or something like that. And now this town of Long Beach is part of Los Angeles County, which is the largest county in the nation. But that meant that now that we go to voting centers, and I think this is a problem really all around the country, where they are moving to a voting center model. Instead of voting at your own precinct, the same precinct essentially year after year, now you can vote for your convenience at these so-called voting centers, meaning you can go to any voting center anywhere in your county and cast your vote. Now, in the case of Los Angeles County, the largest, most populous in the nation, that means there are millions of voters and millions of ballots cast. And in Long Beach, where they had this really close tax initiative on the ballot that barely passed at the time, in order to receive a recount here in Los Angeles, they were going to be charged, even though Long Beach is a very small town, they were going to be charged hundreds of thousands of dollars, because now that you can vote anywhere in this huge county, that meant that the registrar has to go through all the ballots, millions of ballots, to find the few that were cast in Long Beach. Ultimately, they just gave up that recount entirely because they couldn't afford hundreds of thousands of dollars to count this race. That seems to me to be a problem, John, all across the state of California now, when we have these voting centers, and in a whole bunch of other states that also use voting centers for this very same reason.
You're absolutely right. In Los Angeles, we recounted 48,000 ballots by machines in just 2 days for around $26,000. Mm-hmm. I would project that for this race, it should have been a cost to the requester of under $100,000. Mm-hmm. And so some standardization of these costs and facilitating this, because this is essential for our democracy.
Yep.
The outcome of a tie was a mistake. And gratefully, a individual citizen had the courage to force the registrars to find the correct result.
Mm-hmm.
And it should not be this case that the upfront costs in a statewide recount in 2013, a registrar asked for $58,000 before counting a single ballot.
Right.
And there has to be a way for our state and our nation to have an accurate determination of the intent of our voters.
And to standardize the cost, if you have an election with X number of ballots, you should know before you have to ask for a recount that it will cost you X number of dollars based on, you know, a per ballot. You know, the idea, and we have talked over the years, John, that, you know, in some cases, there was another statewide recount that took place some years after yours in 2010. I think it was 2016, where, you know, depending on the county, you would get quotes of, you know, 5 or 10 cents a ballot versus a buck or more a ballot. And there seemed to be no real difference for the changes in those costs. That needs to be standardized, doesn't it, just for fairness sake?
Absolutely. This is a responsibility of the Secretary of State. And I would call on our legislators to study the situation and to propose legislation next year to address this in the future. This is baffling.
These recount issues seem to happen every few years in California, and nobody seems happy about them. I don't know if there is any effort to do anything about it, to make these automated recounts. If it's this close, for crying out loud, the state ought to pay for an automated recount, it seems to me. End of story. Do you have concerns that these problems that obviously exist here in California may haunt the state once again in this November, when every vote, I suspect, will be looked at as closely as possible, given, you know, what is at stake, particularly at the federal level, even here with so many House races that could affect the majority control of the U.S. House?
Absolutely. I think this November is going to be very interesting. I think the control of the House and the Senate will not be known for weeks, and of course, of the White House as well. Unfortunately, I don't believe that there's time to craft new legislation in Sacramento to impact the November election, which is unfortunate.
Very unfortunate, but I do hope this latest folly will sort of help kick Sacramento into gear to realize that we really are playing with fire. John Ma, really appreciate your 2 cents on all of this, and your much more than 2 cents when it came to recounting the entire state of California back in 2010. John Ma is a San Francisco surgeon who has, whether he liked it or not, become a bit of a recount expert across the state of California. John, really appreciate talking to you today. Stay in touch as this crazy year moves forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will take a quick break here. And when we come back, we will try to get caught up on a whole bunch of criminal accountability that is going on today with a bunch of folks seemingly headed for jail. One or more of them, including Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani, Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, and of course, Donald Trump himself, whose former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, took the stand for the first time on Monday to offer his version of the hush money payments made to a porn star before the 2016 election that now has Trump facing some 34 criminal felony charges in a New York courtroom. Love to hear your thoughts on that. We haven't had the chance to open up your phones, open up the phones with your thoughts on the Stormy Daniels trial. If you'd like to ring in, our phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or you give me a call on what's going on, what we were just talking about with Dr. John Ma there, and our concerns about California's brittle and antiquated electoral slash recount system, or any of the other topics. I'd love to hear from you. Quick break, and we are back with all of that. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the world-famous Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Oh, I hope so. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That song could really refer to any number of our accountability stories today. And if you're in our live Southern California listening area or listening via the web stream at kpfk.org and you'd like to ring in on any of them or on our last segment with Dr. John Ma on California's hinky recount laws, feel free to give me a shout at 818-985-5735. You can also tweet me if you can't get through on our phone lines. I am the Brad Blog on the Twitters, and email is bradcast@bradblog.com. Before I get to the accountability real quick, Desi Doyen, you had a question over the break about what John and I were talking about just now.
Yeah, you know, we're often told that, oh, machine tabulators are in voting and elections are much more accurate than humans are, but yet these machines miscounted. So I was just real quick, why do machines miscount?
Okay, well, yeah, we do hear this a lot from people who really, really like computer counting. The problem is, even if they are more accurate, nobody can ever know that until you bother to count the ballots by hand to confirm that the computers were accurate. Sometimes they are miscoded, not on purpose. They're just errors in the programming because all of these computer tabulators have to be programmed with each and every election. It's also a great opportunity for a bad guy to get in there and miscode things on purpose. Again, you can't know one way or another if the machines counted them accurately unless you count the ballots by hand. And yet we hear that, oh, people are much less accurate when they count. Machines are more accurate. Well, that doesn't appear to be the case. And even if it is the case, you can't know that they're accurate until you do the hand count. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit, Desi Doyen. Some of these accountability stories so I can get to some of the people who want to ring in on, well, whatever. If Donald Trump claims that President Biden has weaponized his Justice Department to go after Republicans like Donald Trump, well, President Biden's DOJ sure has a funny way of showing it. Last week, they indicted Texas Democratic U.S. House Rep. Henry Cuellar and his wife on a $600,000 corruption and bribery scheme. And this week, on Monday, in a Manhattan federal courtroom, jury selection began in the trial of Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, a once powerful senator still sitting in the U.S. Senate, a Democrat. He was accused by Biden's DOJ of accepting bribes and of gold and cash to use his influence to deliver favors that would help three New Jersey businessmen. That trial is expected to last up to 6 weeks. The three-term senator has announced he will not be seeking re-election on the Democratic ticket in New Jersey this fall, although he has not ruled out running as an independent. It is the second corruption trial for Menendez in the last decade. The previous prosecution on unrelated charges ended with a deadlocked jury back in 2017. Yes, under Donald Trump's Department of Justice, following charges that were initially filed, I believe, by President Obama's Justice Department. In this new case, in which the trial began on Monday, prosecutors say the senator's efforts on behalf of the businessmen led him to take actions benefiting the governments of Egypt and Qatar. Menendez has vigorously denied doing anything unusual in his dealings with foreign officials, though the gold bars, yes, the gold bars worth more than $100,000 and the more than $486,000 in cash found stuffed into the pockets of clothing at his New Jersey home when it was raided 2 years ago. Well, that might be kind of tough to explain to jurors.
Gold bars in one's jacket, as one does.
Yes. We'll see how that goes. On the Donald Trump side of the accountability ledger today, a U.S. federal appeals court on Friday upheld the conviction of Steve Bannon, the 2016 campaign manager for Donald Trump and a former top White House advisor, for defying a subpoena from the bipartisan congressional panel that investigated the Trump-incited January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The ruling brings Bannon one step closer to serving a four-month prison sentence for contempt of Congress, though he can still mount additional appeals. He was convicted back in 2022 of two counts of contempt for refusing to turn over documents or testify to the House of Representatives committee that was investigating the attack on the Capitol. He has been allowed to remain free during the 2 years of his appeal, arguing that his lawyers advised him that he didn't have to comply with the congressional subpoenas. And he was a top White House advisor at one point, but he believes that, oh, it's optional if you get a congressional subpoena. The committee sought information from Bannon after he had predicted on a podcast the day before the January 6 riot that, quote, all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. But Bannon refused to cooperate with the committee's probe, which he attacked as politically motivated. That tactic did not work for Trump's former trade advisor, Peter Navarro, either. He was also sentenced to 4 months in prison for defying his two subpoenas for testimony and documents, and he's currently serving that time as a federal prisoner now at a facility in Miami. He's in jail. Bannon is still out on appeal. In the final hours in office in 2021, Trump had pardoned Steve Bannon in a separate case related to a federal indictment on charges that he misused money that he helped raise for a private group promising to build a piece of border wall on the southern border. Yes, he was stealing from Trump's own duped supporters, and Trump pardoned him for it before the case could go to trial at the federal level. Bannon has since been accused by state prosecutors in New York of charges similar to those that led to his federal pardon. That trial in New York is scheduled to take place later this year in the very same courthouse where Donald Trump is now being tried on charges of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal threatening his 2016 run for presidency. And we will get to that in a second. But there is just so much Trump-related crime, we can't get to it just yet, because there was also some bad news for Donald Trump's old lawyer and disgraced former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani over the weekend as well. He, as you may know, recently filed for bankruptcy. He's been criminally charged in two states, Georgia and Arizona, for his role in the effort to steal the 2020 presidential election for Trump. He's been targeted in a number of recent lawsuits. He is also been besieged by creditors, including two Georgia election workers, Shay Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, to whom he now owes $148 million. after a court found that he had defamed them by falsely and repeatedly claiming that they were so-called vote hustlers who committed election fraud in the counting room in Fulton County, Georgia, back in 2020. Well, life just got even worse for Rudy over the weekend, I am not sad to say. He was suspended by WABC Radio on Friday in New York, and his daily talk show abruptly canceled after the station said that he violated its policy by trying to discuss discredited claims about the 2020 presidential election on air. John Castamatidis, the billionaire Republican businessman who owns the station, said that he made the decision after Giuliani refused to avoid the topic despite repeated warnings. Katsimatidis said in a brief phone interview, "We're not going to talk about fallacies of the November 2020 election. We warned him once, we warned him twice, and I got a text from him last night and from him this morning that he refuses to not talk about it. So he left me no option. I suspended him." Rudy Giuliani is out. Why he would be allowed on WABC every day to spout disinformation in the first place, well, that's a whole separate question. In a statement, he called WABC's policies a clear violation of free speech. Sure, because as you know, every American is entitled to have their own five-day-a-week talk show over our public airwaves. Otherwise, it's a violation of free speech. I think WABC is violating my free speech by not airing the broadcast every day.
I agree.
Who do I sue? Mr. Katsimatidis said the former mayor earned a percentage of the show's advertising revenues rather than a salary. Times reported last year that Giuliani earned roughly $400,000 a year from WABC. Well, he's certainly losing money now. And sadly, I guess, so will his creditors like Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, whose lives he turned upside down by falsely claiming that they were trying to steal the Georgia election for Joe Biden. And also in Manhattan on Monday, Donald Trump's longtime lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen, took to the stand in New York's 2016 election interference case against the former president on 34 criminal felony counts of falsifying business records to hide his reimbursements to Cohen for a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in 2016 as payments to hide them as payments for legal services, writing personal checks to Cohen once a month during Trump's first year in the Oval Office, when he was writing checks to pay off a hush money scandal to a porn star while serving as president. Cohen is now testifying to having acted at the direction and order and benefit of Donald Trump to pay off Stormy Daniels to help him win the election in 2016. In fact, Cohen himself was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison for having participated in that conspiracy directed by Donald Trump. To date, he has been the only one to directly place Trump at the center of the scheme, although other witnesses to date have detailed how the payments to Cohen were fraudulently described as legal payments to Cohen to help hide them from campaign finance regulators. Hear how things were going on Monday during the lunch break in the case, according to retired Queens Superior Court Judge George Grasso, who was in the courtroom on Monday watching the proceedings and Cohen's first day of testimony when Trump's former lawyer turned enemy recounted Trump's anger at the possibility of his affairs with both Playboy model Karen McDougal and porn star Stormy Daniels going public. Here's Judge Grasso on CNN this afternoon.
He describes an angry Trump confronting him, saying, "I thought you took care of it. I thought you had this under control." And then Trump going on to say, according to Michael Cohen, this, meaning the Stormy Daniels scenario breaking, is a total disaster. Women will hate me. Guys will think it's cool, but this is going to be a disaster for the campaign. That's almost one of the last things the jurors heard before the lunch break. And I can tell you, as I was keeping an eye on jurors and making my notes, They seem to me to be riveted by this testimony. This is so crucial because one of the main goals for the prosecution that Michael Cohen has is to establish a motive and intent directly on Donald Trump that would cause him to take the steps that ultimately led to the $130,000 payment and be involved and be knowledgeable about it. So to me, by far, Wolf, that was the most compelling testimony of the day.
So far, he's been a strong witness for the prosecution. Is that your bottom line?
Absolutely. He comes across poised, cool, calm, and collected. Trump came in with a huge entourage today, about 23 individuals, including Senator J.V. Vance, Senator Tom Tuberville. When they left at the break at about 11:30, that was one somber-looking group. That was my eye, and I was sitting right in the aisle seat. So I don't think they're all too pleased about what they're seeing so far.
was calm and cool and collected? George Grasso, Judge George Grasso right there, giving that report to CNN with jackhammers going on throughout
it's like
it
they
in the background.
Planned the jackhammers to come on while he was on.
Good
but
Lord.
He did it. He concentrated.
818-985-5735 is our phone number if you want to get in real quick as we're coming up to the top of the hour after lunch on Monday, according to AP's reporters in the courtroom. Cohen said that he was told just do it by Donald Trump, saying that Trump advised him to meet with Trump CFO Alan Weisselberg and figure out how to structure these payments. Cohen said that he suggested Weisselberg offer up the money, given his much bigger salary. Weisselberg, however, said that he wasn't in a position to do it. He had obligations for his kids or private schools and so forth. So Cohen made the decision, ultimately saying, okay, I'll pay it. There was recordings of conversations between him and Donald Trump about the payments made to Karen McDougal by National Enquirer, also on Donald Trump's behalf, to catch and kill that story. A lot of stuff going on. We will cover it more and more as the week goes on. But let me see if I can get to some of your calls here. 818-985-KPFK. Let's go to Larry in San Pedro. Hey, Larry, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Brad. About 2 hours ago, NPR reported that the doorman got a check for $30,000 to keep quiet because he had information that Trump had a child out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. My question to you, sir, is that old news or new news? And number two, is it going to be devastating for Trump? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate the call. In fact, that is old news that those rumors about the doorman have since been confirmed to have come from the doorman. But most everyone who has looked at that case, including Michael Cohen, including David Pecker, the publisher of the National Enquirer, who ultimately paid off that guy to buy his story, $30,000, I believe it was. They have all concluded that the story isn't true, that the story by the former Trump doorman that Donald Trump had impregnated, I believe it was a housekeeper who worked at Trump Tower, that in fact that was not true, that it was a false story. Nonetheless, they paid him $30,000 to shut up about it. They paid Karen McDougal $150,000 to shut up about a supposedly nine-month affair that she had with Donald Trump while his wife Melania was pregnant with their son Barron. Those were all paid through the National Enquirer. Trump was supposed to pay the National Enquirer back, and then never did. And eventually the Enquirer said, look, you know what? Don't pay us back. We don't want the money, after David Pecker, I think, realized that it would be an unlawful finance federal election crime, in fact, to pay $150,000 to help his campaign without reporting it. And besides, you can't pay that much to any one campaign in any one election. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to Morris, that we haven't seen from Morris in quite a while. Hey, Mo, are you okay there?
How you been, Bradley? Listen, I got a question for you. When Eugene Debs went to prison, during the Woodrow Wilson era, did Woodrow Wilson put him in prison or did the courts put him in prison? I'm going to take your response off here. Well, How you doing, Bradley? Nice to hear from you again, too.
Good to hear from you, Mo. I'm not sure where he gets the idea that a president could simply put Eugene Debs into prison. You'd have to go through the court system, to my knowledge. That was Eugene Debs who ran as a socialist from prison back in 1920. Des, you had looked into that.
Yeah, I looked it up really
question?
Quick. Yeah? And so basically Eugene Debs had led a boycott against handling trains with Pullman cars in what became known as the huge Pullman strike.
Yep.
And at the time, President Grover Cleveland used the United States Army to break the strike using the keeping the mail running as his excuse. And so what happened was Debs was convicted of federal charges for defying a court injunction against the strike, and that's when he was put into prison. So he defied the court, contempt of court, an injunction, and was put in jail for that.
Okay. So as far as Woodrow Wilson personally putting him into jail,
that doesn't sound like that's what happened.
But he was able to run for president from jail.
Yes, he was.
Just so everyone knows, there is a precedent for Trump. If he's convicted here in this New York case, which looks to be the only one that's likely to come, to much less get to trial, much less reach a conviction before the election, if he was convicted or just sent to prison for contempt of court for any more violations of his gag order in the New York case, yes, he could go to prison, and yes, he could run from prison. There is nothing in our Constitution, and perhaps there should be, I don't know. Maybe that's a good question for callers on another day, because to some extent, you know, if the charges are bogus against someone, they should be able to run, make their case, and make the case that the charges are bogus. But in any event, currently, there is nothing in our Constitution that prevents Donald Trump from running, even if he is behind bars on Election Day. And by the way, the chances of that are very slim, even in the New York case, even if he is convicted, because there will likely be years and years of appeals before he actually heads off to the Gray Bar Hotel.
Or the Pokey.
But we hope it happens soon for those of us who believe in democracy, justice, the constitutional order, and the rule of law. But that's just me. We'll talk about it another day. We got to get out. That day may be tomorrow. Until then, I want to thank Desi Doyen, our producer. Thank our board operator, Wendell Handy. Thank our guest today, Dr. John Ma. And thank all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free or any other show we've ever done at bradblog.com. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you'll also find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.